Before we go to the, so to say, to the results, couple of considerations. I write here, this is the potential of sigma and pi. And let me also add the dilaton part. So this would be our dilaton potential, which depends on g. So first thing, what we say that we set g to a constant, to its minimum, and then we consider only the last part, is strictly speaking not the correct way to do. In principle, one has a potential which depends on sigma and g, if you assume that pi doesn't condense because it's a pseudo-scalar field, and one has to find the minimum in a two-dimensional space, because one has to find the minimum in a space of g and sigma. But, so to say, on a practical level, one can, in order to understand how things work, one can do what I say, that you basically set g to a constant and neglect its fluctuation. The fact that we can do it is also due to the fact that the globals correspond to the fluctuation of g, to the dilaton potential. The function of g was something of this type. It's also due to the fact that the mass of the global is pretty heavy, so 1.7 GV or something like that. And then, so for that reason, the fluctuation is far away from the other resonances, and one can first consider it as constant. But this only is a first approximation. In principle, one has to consider a minimum of sigma and g of this potential. It's something, just to the two derivative with respect to sigma and to g, and find the minimum. So it is a bit longer, so I will not do it here, but just to know which is the right way to proceed. But once we fix, if we fix, then we care only about sigma and pi. Now the question is, does sigma condense? And in order to see if sigma condense, we should simply take the derivative with respect to sigma and set it to zero. So I take it, the derivative with respect to sigma, g fixed. So we do not consider the variation of g. This is fixed to its value. This is m0 squared sigma plus 4 lambda 2 sigma to the power of 3. And this should be set equal to 0. And then we see that, of course, sigma equals 0 is always a solution. But there is another solution, sigma squared, equal to minus m0 squared divided 4 lambda 2. And this exists only if m0 squared is negative. And here we can also see that this chiral condensate, I mean this condensate sigma, is actually proportional to minus a, this was m0 was a lambda dilaton squared divided 4 lambda 2. So the chiral condensate is proportional to this dilaton constant. This is obvious from the very fact that lambda dil is the only thing with a dimension, and that everything which has a dimension must be proportional to that. Of course, again, if you do the things properly, actually there is this potential will also generate a mixing of sigma and g and so on and so forth. But these are only extra complications on the stuff. But the basic idea is there, is this. Then there are two other comment. Here we also have two other terms, LASB and LUA1. So what are these part? LASB is the breaking of symmetry, and it is usually parametrized by the following form, 1 half trace matrix H phi plus phi dagger, where this matrix H is actually proportional to the matrix M of the quark masses. Proportional because here there is a composite level, so there is another constant. So we see that If H were proportional to the identity, all the masses are equal, you still have flavor symmetry, but you do not have chiral symmetry. Chiral symmetry is immediately broken when H is non-zero. You can see it from this term by just applying this transformation. But flavor symmetry is still fulfilled, because if you have U dagger equal, because of the property of the trace, you can rotate it back and then cancel it. And here, there is a point which we will also discuss tomorrow. And one cannot really... So if you calculate the mass of the pion, at this level is zero, but when you introduce this term, it's not zero, but it is proportional, it is actually equal to this parameter H divided by the condensate sigma zero. Let me call it sigma zero, this condensate. This is the result of the calculation. I would like just to discuss it. So you see that let me just, because I didn't introduce it, let me put it, let me put H first, HU, HU, HS. This is proportional to the constant HU divided sigma zero. And HU is proportional to the quark mass U, this is proportional to the quark mass D, but in isospin limit these are equal, and then there is this one. So what we see is that the pion mass squared is proportional to the U quark mass. And this is something which is completely not intuitive. Because, so imagine that you start from a quark and you have two masses. The mass of the pion naively should be proportional to the quark mass. That would be what you would expect. But you don't have this. You have that the pion mass squared is proportional to the quark mass. This is a peculiarity of spontaneous symmetry breaking, and the fact that symmetry is spontaneously broken, and on top of that you have an explicit breaking. And this is why this mass has this definitely, completely non-trivial behavior. So with this, the mass of the meson square goes with the mass of the quark linearly. So this is, of course, non-trivial, and this has been very well verified on the lattice, where one can change the quark mass and plot mp squared. And you see wonderfully this linearity, and this is, of course, a wonderful proof of the correctness of all these ideas from this lattice results. And this is also so-called Gore relation, was also mentioned. Also, this was mentioned yesterday in the exam. What else? Then there is another term, which is the anomaly that we still didn't, that I would like just to mention for completeness, which is this one here, LUA1. So maybe I do the following. I do not erase everything. I erase only this part. So I give the Lagrangian there yet. What is this here? Oh, there was a larger one. Here it is, the big one. And there are different ways to describe this UA1, but a clever way makes, I mean, usually they all make you, they all use some kind of determinant. See that phi minus that phi dagger squared. Close here. So why this determinant? So remember that if we consider a transformation phi go to UL phi UR dagger, the determinant is transforming to determinant of UL phi UR dagger, but because of the probability of the property of the determinant, I can split it into three parts, the product of the determinant. If now, in general, this is not invariant if you are in U3, but if you take SU3, for SU3 right, SU3 left, you can neglect these two terms. I mean, in that case, you just take the special unitary group. The determinant is 1, so this is equal to the determinant of phi, and you have invariance. But if you take the UA1, you break it. So this is exactly the idea behind it. So if this term is such that it breaks exactly the UA1 symmetry, but it still preserve the rest, SU3 right and SU3 left. And this is why it is put in order to model this stuff. And I mean, this term gives basically a mass of the eta. Suppose, consider just for a second a one flavor dimension. Suppose that phi is a constant, then you would have something sigma plus eta would be a number. Then here inside you have sigma plus I eta minus sigma plus I eta. So you get something which is an eta squared term. So you give a mass to the eta, actually in the SU3 version to the eta prime. So you give a mass to the singlet configuration. So the U bar U plus D bar D plus S bar S gets it. Okay, then one has to do everything properly with the mixing and so on. But this is basically what happens. So again, the idea is that so one has a model which contains basically not only the symmetries but also the symmetry breakings that we know from QCD. Now the point is the following. This model is beautiful, already contains various particles. If you take it for 3 flavors, you would have 9 plus 9, 18 particles plus the glue ball. This is already 19 particles. There is a problem, it doesn't work. I mean, if you try to fit to data, you will see that this model doesn't really give you good results. The reason is that one is missing some important resonances that should be there, but that this model doesn't contain yet. And these resonances are vector mesons and axial vector mesons that we also discussed yesterday, these nonets. And first, let me clean. And the way to construct the vector mesons and the axial vector meson is actually the same. I mean, one should also take into account this model was studied in very details from the very beginning, then it was dismissed, so to say, for the fact that it could not describe properly the scalar mesons. Also, pion-pion scattering was not fully correctly described, and so on and so forth. So it has the right symmetry. Everything is good, so to say, but it is not complete, and this is why it also fails then the comparison with data. Of course, when we went over the phenomenology of meson, we saw that there were much more than only scalar and pseudoscalar. There was a full list of states, and the vector states, the raw meson, and their partner are, of course, very important for that. And so how does it work? So let's say vector meson, vector and axial vector meson. So one starts from some right-handed configuration. One defines it like that. It is very similar to what we had before. 2qjr gamma mu q ir. This is first a matrix of quark, anti-quark states. I just put a gamma mu inside. The transformation of r mu of this matrix. Notice that there is a difference. Before I had right-left, now I have right-right. Why? Because if I put right-left, you would get 0 because of these projectors. You just do just the calculation, you would get 0. You are obliged to put the same R and R in order to add a non-trivial current. And the transformation, this is why it's also called right, is that it gets the right transformation from both sides. And then there is the brother or the sister, which is the same, but with left-left. So now we have again, so to say, other objects which are analogous to the phi. They have a different transformation because the phi was transformed as a UL phi UR dagger. But you see the similarity. You have blocks that you can put in your Lagrangian and very easily check invariance under chiral symmetry because it is a very simple transformation. And this is, so to say, what it is done. The question is still how to relate this right and left to physical states. But exactly as before, if we take the right, for instance, R mu ij, this is equal to 2 qjp. Left, gamma mu p right qe. Then I put this here, 2 q JPL squared, but PL squared is equal PL. We already saw it. QI. And this is equal the QJ. The two disappear. Minus QJ gamma 5 gamma mu QI. And here I recognize the vector state and the axial vector state. In other words, R mu is equal to vector minus axial vector. And left mu is actually given by vector plus axial vector. Still, when you write down the Lagrangian, we don't use V and A because they transform not in a simple way under chiral transformation. One uses the blocks R and L. Later on, when you go to the physical fields, one has, of course, to go back to the physical states, V and A. So this is, so to say, the procedure. And now I will show you on the slides, I will show you, so to say, some results. Yes, it's a stick about where to put the gamma 5.
Yes.
On the left, on the actually, this is a definition of 8 minus A is completely independent. I think that in the paper we use this one.
Yeah. Then it's always used.
But one should be consistent, otherwise it is a
problem. Yeah, of course.
Okay, so development of hadronic model general considerations. So the idea, what I will present now, is basically this, the full model based on the discussion that I did on the blackboard. So we have a chiral symmetric models, which includes scalar, pseudo-scalar, vector and axial vector mesons. It should be mentioned that also many people worked on the baryons, so to include also the nucleon and also baryons with strangeness. What we did, the first thing is to study the model in the vacuum, but one of the big things which is pursued here in Frankfurt is also to study properties at non-zero temperature and non-zero density. So not only in the vacuum, one would like also to study the phase transitions, the chiral phase transition, for instance, when increasing the temperature or increasing the density or both of them, and the order of phase transition as well. So fields of the models, this is written here. We have scalar, pseudo-scalar, vector, and axial vector quark-antiquark fields. And additional mesons are the scalar glueball from the very beginning. And indeed, we also coupled the pseudo-scalar glueball and lately the vector glueball as well. But this, I didn't still change the slides because this was just 3 weeks ago. And baryons then later on also. The idea is the following. Confinement implies that only hadrons are into the model, so there are no quarks. So already these objects are only inside, no quarks. dilatation invariance and its anomalous breaking, which is this piece is inside, and only this is the dimensionful parameter in the chiral limit. And of course, the chiral anomaly and the breakings that we discussed. Yes?
Is this dilatation invariance somehow realized in other approaches to low energy QCD, like chiral perturbation theory or something like that?
Chiral perturbation theory starts immediately with the fpi in it.
In the broken phase, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it cannot describe that.
Okay.
Because from the very beginning, there is a dimension in this matrix. And if you put a dimension like that, then you don't see the dilaton anymore. But there are various models which, in some form or the other, used this Lagrangian. This for sure. I mean, we believe that we have done it in a full consistent way with the vector and axial vector, but there are, of course, other groups. Also here, also in Frankfurt, for heavy ion, for instance, that used models with various fields with the dilaton, but then they didn't care about all chiral symmetry in the rest of the Lagrangian. So the point is the following, from gluons to gluons. This is already discussed, but just as a review, the gluon is first massless. We may say with all the correct warning that we have a kind of effective gluon mass that, however, is not breaking dilatation, is not breaking gauge symmetry. So it is actually a dressing of the gluon propagator. It should be understood. But you have a scale which comes in, which, so to say, gives something like 500 MeV or even more. So this is also how you can understand the glueball. The 1,601.7 GV of the glueball is because the gluon itself gets a lot of energy through dressing with gluon loops. Confinement implies glueballs, and this is again the full glueball spectrum. This is actually already shown one. This is a older. This is the, one of the first full calculations of the glueball. 1999. The one that I showed yesterday or the day before yesterday was 2006, but it didn't really change much. Okay, some excited states disappear that here were listed, and now in the new calculations they didn't find it, or they didn't want to quote them. So the lightest glue ball is then part of this effective Lagrangian, this dilaton that I just repeat. This is what we have seen in these days. This is this dilaton potential, which has this form, and then the condensate of the dilaton is here, and the fluctuation is here. And this is, so to say, how this is a QCD, and this is the model. So the model gets a G to the 4, which mimics the QCD breaking of dilatation invariance. Where is the glue ball? There are many candidates, mostly in the history of 0, 15, and 1500, and 1510. We will, at present, this is the best result. Later I will say more. Quark anti-quark, this is already C, I don't have to go. We have many quark-anti-quark state. So this is, again, the matrix of pseudo-scalar that we've seen yesterday and again today. So this is P. All the states are listed here. And theta N and theta S are mixed in this form. And here you see the correspondence to quark-anti-quark fields. And the matrix in between is the I gamma 5 to get pseudo-scalar objects. So that we just list all of them together. This is the scalar. And again, with the identity inside and with the correspondence to heavy states, 14, 13, 70 for one, and the 80 is the 0, 14, 50, and not the 0, 180. So these are heavy states. The lightest are tetraquarks or something else. And this is, again, the very same stuff that we saw with the blackboard. If I combine this scalar plus I pseudoscalar, I get an object which transforms very beautifully under chiral transformation. And an example of an invariant term, it was the lambda 2, which is exactly here. And then you see you just play with this transformation and everything cancels wonderfully. So we don't need to go to detail because we did it at the blackboard. Then the axial vector sector, it was here. The vector nonet of vector meson is written here. So you just have the gamma mu between the quarks. And here I have the famous rho meson, the k star 892, the omega and the phi, very well-known resonances. At first, here, the mixing is small, so omega is basically UU bar plus DD bar, and phi is dominated by the S bar S component. Small mixing, some 2 or 3 degrees present, but is negligible at first. And these are the axial vector meson. They are not so well known because they are broad. For instance, this A1-1230, there is an error, is a very broad state. It is a width of between 200 and 600 MeV. This is why, I mean, it truly exists, but it is still, so to say, a bit more difficult to settle because of this large width. But the two F1 are better known. So the, oh, this is an error. This should be F1N. This is an error. It should be like this one. I forgot to do the substitution. And here, what I said, one construct the sum and the difference. And for this right-handed and left-handed, again, this is what we had on the blackboard. Example of further invariant objects. OK, this. I have seen before, we have seen invariant objects for the phi field, and here it is invariant object which involve UL. I mean, you see that here you get UL, UL dagger, UL, UL dagger, they always cancel. And this is some mixing term which mixes pseudo-scalar mesons and axial vector, vector and axial vector meson. And it's, of course, if you do the game, all the U cancel with each other, the same thing. So in total, we have then four nonets, 36 quark anti-quark fields, plus one global and one scalar global, and eventually we can already include the pseudo-scalar global that was coupled later on. These already make 38 mesons, which is pretty big. And as I said, dilatation symmetry with its breaking and chiral invariance are the principle, and of course, charge, conjugation, and parity also, because QCD is invariant under these transformations. Put all together, this is what you get, and this is the Lagrangian of the extended linear sigma model. There are actually further terms that are not relevant for the moment, so everything compact here and written. I would say that the most important paper in which everything is described is this 2013 one here. So this is, so to say, the form that it has. And as I said, the expanded version, it is in at most in one Mathematica file. This is again Buridan. We already discussed about the breaking of chiral symmetry, but the point is that this term here, this term here must be the right sign in order to break it. It is just written not with the A, but with some grouping of G0. This is just algebra. It is not, it's not important.
Some terms missing
in the Lagrangian? I think that
the
G2. The G2 is missing.
All G
complex, right? No, the G1 is inside the DMU.
Yeah, but
yeah, these are the extra terms, yes. These are terms which are not important for the decays. So I should put plus dot, 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 yeah, further term, but they are not important in what I'm telling you today. So there is breaking of chiral symmetry. So the potential is basically the Mexican hat. It's simply a complicated version. And then, of course, I don't have only a condensate of quark anti-quark field, I also have a condensate of S bar S field. So everything should be, so to say, put in the right framework and do the shifts and so on, which is technically very involved. I mean, it was surely the full PhD of Denis Pargaglia and then the full PhD of Stanislaus Janowski to put also the global, the G in it. So, of course, it was, I would say, 6 years of work, even longer. And all the others who collaborated, of course. So, but the idea is the following. I mean, microscopic decay of the rho plus, this is the decay of a rho plus into pi plus pi zero. Microscopically, it is like that, of a UD bar, which go apart, and you have a creation of a UU bar from the vacuum, and then you have two pions. But such a model doesn't see the quark. So what you see is simply a three-level coupling, after you do all the shifts and so on, of a rho plus to a pi zero, pi plus. But this coupling is proportional to the condensates, to all these things that are into the Lagrangian from the very beginning. And then all decays are related to each other because of that. Masses and decays are related to each other. So this is, so even if we do not see what it is inside, so this loop of triangle of quarks is hidden into one point in the model. And this was the result. There were 11 parameters which were fitted to 21 experimental quantities, which are listed in this. The total chi-squared per degrees of freedom were 1.2, which is good. So remember that the chi-squared, so a good chi-squared should be always something like 1 plus minus square root of 2 divided number of degrees of freedom, more or less. Should be in this range. So if you have many degrees of freedom, the larger is the degrees of freedom that you have, the closer should your chi-squared to 1. And actually, this was also my question yesterday to Thomas. When we did a mistake because we took too large error, we get a chi-squared of reduced of 0.25 or 0.3. When you have something like that, you should immediately be suspicious. Because a too small chi-squared means that you either overestimated your error or that your theory is simply too good. Yeah, so the point, suppose that you have some data that are like, the data will not follow exactly the curve, exactly the theoretical curve. Suppose that the exact result is this curve here. The data will oscillate around it. So the chi-squared will be something like 1. But if you have a theory which exactly matches the data, you see that it is unnatural. So a theory which goes exactly into all the data and the chi-squared is too small, something is wrong, or you are overestimated the error or something like that.
Could you please tell this to the transport guys?
Do they get a small chi-squared or what?
No, it's every talk about transport you see here in Frankfurt, you see the experimental data, and you see their curves, and it fits so good, it is so unreal what they do.
Then they have too many parameters. If you have too many parameters,
yes,
then you go exactly through all the points.
Yeah, they have a lot of parameters, but yeah. In their talks, they don't tell us how they fix the parameters or how they fit the parameters to experimental data, and it's completely...
Well, one, of course, may does. I mean, in the end, one should get this. This is a good... within this range, one should get a reasonable fit. So this is when then Thomas found the error, the mistake that he did, that he took two large errors, then we get a chi-square of 1.2 or 3, and we were very happy. But this is a general requirement. So also here, 1.2 is absolutely okay. I mean, if you look here, for instance, there all we get 116 EV instead of 150. Okay, obviously, if you try to fit everything, you cannot describe everything correctly, because this theory neglects some things, neglects, for instance, breaking of isospin, which is the U and D quark are set equal. So you already put some errors in it. And this is also an important point. If you should also, when you try to fit, this is general, your theory to experimental data. If the experiment is too precise with respect to the accuracy of your theory, you shouldn't put the theoretical error into the fit. Because you will get a very high chi-squared, but the point is that your theory was not designed for such a precision. So we did, for instance, in this fit, we did the following. The error are either those of the particle data group, so the experimental error, or when they were too small, we took 5% of the value, because our estimate is that the theory cannot be more precise than that. So this is a subtle but important point. This is general. When you do a fit to some experimental data, you should also first have a look to how precise are the experimental data with respect to your theory. So there are some cases where experimental data are extremely precise, but because of your approximation, you already know that you will never get 1 per mil. So this is a general but important comment. For instance, the if pi, the first entry, 4.6 MeV is not its error. I mean, this is this 5%. The error of the if pi is very, very small. But we will never pretend that within this context, with the approximation that we have done, we would ever get something which is at the per mil precision, and so on. This is the very same stuff for masses and decay. This is theory minus error divided error. As soon as you have something close to zero, this is good. And it shows that it doesn't matter which quantity we take. So the mass of the eta is a bit off. But I mean, everything is more or less OK. More or less, okay. And, okay, this is also a point. When you do errors, when you do a fit, there are basically three things that one can do when you do a fit. One is to find the minimum. Second is to determine the errors of your parameter. And third is to determine the goodness of the fit. This is actually what one should always do. Many people in physics don't do it. They stop at the first. They just look for the minimum, and that's it. But that is not enough. You should also evaluate the error of your parameter, and this is not trivial, because there are some, when you write your chi-squared and you have to minimize a function, you should be careful that the parameters of your theory may not be independent to each other. So one has actually to do a rather involved, although straightforward, procedure in order to get the right error of your parameters, and then whatever you want to calculate on top, you should be careful. Because if you just do the plain error propagation formula, you would most probably overestimate your error. And this is also what we had with Florian, for instance, and before also in other cases. By the way, just before going on, if I just put again this, 11 parameters means that we're looking for a minimum of a function in 11-dimensional space. This is, of course, also from the point of view of computational difficulty, not so trivial. And of course, we didn't find a single minimum. We found also other local minima, but they were sitting higher. They were given to a chi-squared, which was worse than 2, and this is why we rejected them. So this was the best minimum. Of course, with a numerical procedure, you will never be fully sure that you have found the absolute minimum. So because, this, you always start somewhere. It depends on where you start, and then the program is trying to get the minimum around that. But if your minimum was completely on the other side, you will never find it. So this is also some stuff. And of course, in general, to find the minima, you should always work pretty hard. Depends. If you have only 3 parameters, it's no problem. But if you have 11, it is already some work. Of course, then once you have your fit and you've determined your parameter and so on, you can calculate the errors. You can calculate many other things. For instance, there were these 2 ratios. A0 eta prime pi divided eta pi, and A0 1450, both of them are 4050, eta prime pi eta pi, and the other is count over eta pi. So this is the theory, and this is the corresponding experimental value. You see, if you're taking into account the error, they are both in agreement with that. Now you may ask, why didn't you put this into the fit? No, I do not know. The point is that, yes, in principle, we could have taken this and put it to the fit. There was no reason not to do it, but we didn't do it, and then we didn't change it afterward because we were so happy to have found the result. But it's compatible. If we had put these 2 in the fit, we would have not 21, but 23 experimental quantity. Most probably, the minimum would have moved slightly in order to take into account this more precisely. But the fact that it works is still OK. When you do a fit, you should choose which are the quantities you put in the fit and what can you calculate afterwards. Usually, if all the experimental quantities are on the same level, you should put it to the fit. So in principle, we should have put those in the fit. But we didn't want to do it. We didn't do it, and that's it. This was the stage. Sometimes one doesn't follow linear path when looking for something. Then there is another thing that we've done, other consequence. It is this mixing that I already presented sometimes, eta and eta prime. We find something like minus 44 degrees, or almost so maximal mixing of these 2 components into the 2 physical states. Experimentally, the Chloe collaboration from Frascati finds something which is very close to that. So we were happy because this was also something later on. Then there are other things. For instance, this is the raw mass. It gets 3 pieces. This is not so important. But these 2 pieces, one piece which is directly proportional to the dilaton expectation value, the vacuum expectation value of the dilaton, and one which is directly proportional to the chiral condensate. By the way, the chiral condensate is also proportional to the dilaton. So everything in the end should be proportional to lambda g, lambda dilaton, because G0 is lambda dil. But here it shows that basically there are 2 contributions to the raw mass. One which comes from directly from the interaction with the glue ball, with the dilaton, and one which comes with the interaction with the quark. So, and this was important because people for many, many years started to understand what happens if I go at finite temperature. And in previous models, they had only this term, so to say, something proportional to the chiral condensate. And if in the vacuum this is going to 0, they were telling that the raw meson would also go to basically to a very small value. Here it doesn't look really like that because the dilaton changes very slightly with temperature because this dilaton is heavy, is very inert. So even if I go at finite temperature, I basically get rid of this term, but this term stays, and the raw mass basically doesn't change much. This is actually in agreement with the experiment. So this was an extra thing. In the experiment, they tried to go at finite temperature and see if the raw mass changes, but they didn't find it. They find that it actually broadens the raw meson, but this is a effect in the medium effect, but they didn't find a decrease of the mass. At least not a significant one. And not also that it is nonlinear. This is a quadratic sum of two quadratic terms. So the point is that both of them are big. So 650 MeV, 450 MeV. Because not the sum of two terms, but it's the squared of the rho is the sum of two squared. Okay, these were the scalar meson, which was a big discussion. These are the three scalar meson. We tried also to fit all of them. And this was then the work that Stani has done. Let me go to his result. This was his final result after 4 years of work. And this was, you see, the three isoscalar meson, 1370, 1500, 1710, are mixed with quark antiquark, UU bar, DD bar, quark antiquark, SS bar, and a glue ball. And this is the final result. And you see, this is the component, this is the probability squared. If I square this probability, I get the probability that 1710 is made by UU bar, DD bar. If I square this number, I get the probability that it is an SS bar. And if I square the number, it is a glue ball. So you see that 1710 is mostly a glue ball because this number is larger than the other. And at the same time, 1370 is mostly a UU bar, DD bar, and 1500 is mostly a SS bar. So this was then our final result on the isoscalar sector, which was definitely also here a long work. And this is the pseudoscalar glue ball. So the point is that here we do not have any data because there is not yet experiment in this respect. But and then what we could do is just prediction. And at Panda, they will do proton-antiproton, and we hope that they will measure if there is something like that. We fix the max to the lattice, 2.6 GeV, and we simply did this prediction, and we say that, so what we tell, this is basically a message to the experimentalist. We agree with lattice, and we say, look at around 2.6 GeV, and check if there is a resonance, pseudoscalar, which decays in count-count pion, mostly. Then it should also have some sizable decay in eta pion-pion, and eta prime pion pion, and then the other are small. So they should go and see if there is a 2.6 GeV, such a resonance, with these three decay channels, the biggest, and then all the rest. So this is then a prediction in this sense. So it's not anymore a post-diction that we use data, but it is a prediction of something that should come later on. And let's see, up to now, there was one candidate with a mass of 2.37 GeV found by BEST3, but they didn't measure this decay yet, these branching ratios. 2.37 is not so far from the 2.6 of the lattice, what should also take into account that lattice, this one, has some error of at least 150 MeV for sure for the highest, for these heavy glue balls. Still, I think this is nice because it is not only what we described that was already there, it's also something that should be described later. Of course, this we will see. We might well be wrong with that. But at least it's a clear message to what to look for. And by the way, this is a simple isospin consequence. Pion, pion, pion should vanish. So this resonance should not go into three pions. Okay, these are the other glue balls. As I said, we can study all of them. Lately, we did this with a similar framework. We also found the branching ratio in which it should decay most. And then there is all the others should still be done. And that's it about the model. So this is basically this model with axial vector meson and with the fitting to the experimental results. And it works very well, and it works very well from the pion to resonances at the level 1.7 GeV. And this is non-trivial, that it works so well for such a big energy range. Chiral perturbation theory that I will discuss tomorrow describe only the pions, only the low-lying states, very well. For that, it is unbeatable, because, of course, nothing can compete with chiral perturbation theory when it comes to soft pionic interaction because it is designed for that, but it misses all the other mesons on top. One could add them, but one misses also the relation because of chiral symmetry, so to say, hidden. While here, chiral symmetry is evident from the Lagrangian because of the relation of chiral partners and this chiral transformation. Other things that we still have some time for today is the following. There is one technical aspect of this model that it is so-called extended linear sigma model, extended because of the vector meson, the axial vector meson, which is very important at a practical level, but that no one would ever tell it in a, or, I mean, that is only quickly mentioned at conferences and so on. And this is, so to say, a very peculiar mixing of the A1 with the pi. So I will not go into the details, but just that this should be at least mentioned. So in the Lagrangian, before symmetry breaking, before spontaneous symmetry breaking, you have a term, an innocuous looking term, which involves the sigma, A1, mu, and the pion. You have a term of this type. Looks nothing particular. This would be an interaction of one sigma with one pion and one A1. But then the sigma condenses. Sigma n is then sent to its vacuum expectation value plus sigma n. That means that then you get, when you, instead of the field, you put a constant, you get a mixing of the A1 vector, axial vector meson with the pion. And, I mean, the mixing term, actually this is proportional to a constant which is called G1. The mixing term with that is this vertex is something like G1, this chiral condensate, which is also called phi n in the model, phi 0, phi n, it always changes. And then there is A1 mu, the mu p. This has a lot of consequences. For instance, if I look at sigma to pion, one has some direct coupling of sigma to pion, but the model has also some coupling of sigma n to A1, A1. But because of this mixing, the A1 turns into the pion, and they have another contribution to sigma to pion. And this is what the sigma model without the axial vector meson and the vector meson doesn't have, because this A1 is never there from the very beginning. And this changes completely the phenomenology. And this is why the old sigma model without the axial vector meson was not getting this property. This was far too big, about something like almost an order of magnitude bigger than what one would expect. So there are really some subtle things and technical aspects, which are, however, very important when calculating then quantities that were into the table before. So this is this A1 pion mixing is most probably the most important one. Then there are similar mixing of F1 mu to eta and so on. So F1 mu eta and farther. I mean, but they are basically, so to say, all the same from the idea. They all related to that. And this also has another consequence, is that the model gets much, much longer when you get rid of this mixing by proper redefinition of the field, of the fields and so on. It gets much, much longer. So this is also a source of complication, which has implied that we need it so long in order to get then results and to finish the fit. Okay, then what is the next plan? The next plan, we can slightly start today. I would say this is, I would like to say something about chiral perturbation theory, very, very, at a very simple level. So this the linear sigma model or the extended linear sigma models are based on the linear realization of chiral symmetry. Linear because you have chiral partners, you have the pseudo-scalar and the scalar, vector and the axial vector on the same footing. While this chiral perturbation theory only has the pions in its purest first version, only has the pions and eventually the counts in it, so the pseudo-scalar meson. Only the matrix P, there is no matrix S in it. And where is the point behind it? Why do people do it, and why it is still one of the most important procedure to that? Did we have it here? Okay, let me first do the following. Suppose that you want to do pion-pion scattering. The model will, the linear sigma model or the extended linear sigma model, let's take the linear sigma model, we don't have to do it difficult, just to get the idea, will have basically two contributions to pion-pion scattering. There will be a term, which is a repulsion, which will be proportional actually to this parameter lambda 2, which is a contact interaction term. This is a contact repulsion between the two. And then there is an attraction, which is due to the sigma n in the middle. And it, at first, when you look at it, it looks magically that they basically cancel each other. And so to say, the result is almost zero. Actually, in the chiral limit, if you take the mass of the pion to zero, pion-pion scattering is very, very small in the limit of soft pions. So you have two very, very slow pions scattering to each other. And you find that this intensity of scattering is very, very small. And this is very surprising at first, because you say, how is it possible? Here I have something very big minus something very big, and it cancels to almost zero. When you have something like that, this is always the result of a symmetry or something like that. It cannot be by chance, you expect. And indeed, it's not by chance. This is a result of chiral symmetry. And the approach of chiral perturbation theory, which starts only from pion and doesn't have the sigma, sees it from the very beginning, just by its construction. It would have only a single, so to say, pion, 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 pion of this type, but with some derivative in it. And the derivative involves the momentum, and when the momentum is small, the interaction is small. So the point is that it starts, so to say, from a different way, and it can describe some things much, so to say, I wouldn't say better, but in much more naturally and with less effort than the a linear description. It's not that the linear description is wrong, but if you want to do pion-pion scattering, to take into account this subtle cancellation is always more difficult than to have a single term which already does the things. And so now the question is how to go from the linear sigma model to the chiral perturbation theory. One possibility is actually what Florian has done in his work that we would like soon to publish. We still have to write the answer of the to the referee. Who? What did the referee tell us? Yeah, the referee told us that we are lazy because we didn't calculate exactly pion-pion scattering. But the point is that why we didn't we do it, and this we should also use it for the answer, is that if we derived chiral perturbation theory out of the sigma model, if we have the new Lagrangian, which is chi pt1, then we can just do, repeat what the other have done, but then there is no point. It's enough to check the coefficients. So why should we redo the job that they have already done millions of times? This could be an answer. Still, it is good if we add some formula to the answer in order to make him happy. I hope that the referee will not look these lectures, but yeah. So the point is that, so I told us you should calculate this this explicitly, but indeed, so many people did it that we wanted just to show that the extended linear sigma model is boiled down to chiral perturbation theory when you integrate out all the heavy fields, so the sigma n, the rho, etc. And you have a Lagrangian which now depends only on the pion. Before telling more about it, let me make small so example. What does it mean to integrate out? On a very basic level. Suppose that I give you a theory, an interaction Lagrangian, which is given by G, A, B squared. And the mass of A is larger than the mass of B. And you would like to study the scattering of B. So you would have B, B, A, B, B would be, of course, one diagram contributing to it. And the matrix, the amplitude corresponding to this process would be proportional to G squared divided the propagator of A, pi squared minus ma squared. If now p is small because you consider some soft b coming in, and you could, p squared much smaller than ma squared, this would be the meaning, you would have something of this type. So you could actually rewrite an effective theory which contains only B and whose interaction is minus lambda B at the power of 4, where lambda is then something like G squared divided MA squared. Okay, this is the very basic idea. So you start from this. This is like squeezing to a point. You do not see the inside, and it does like this. Actually, you know already something from very basic, for sure from courses of quantum field theory where this is already done, and this is the Fermi-Lagrangian. So the Fermi-Lagrangian is the interaction of a neutrino with an electron, and we can do it here. It is neutrino electron, and no, this is then it should go inside. Yeah. Yes. And this is proportional to GF, but in reality, what we really have is that these two states, so the effective version of a theory in which I create a W minus in the middle, which goes again to that. But this is so heavy that I do not see it, and practically I see just a contact interaction between these two. So the basic idea of integrating out fields is easy, of course. The mathematics is not easy at all. It requires some hard work. This is only the dominant term. If you would like also to get farther terms, what one should do is to... So one should... not only stop at the first order, but to do an expansion. So you have the mass of this field A squared with 1 minus P squared divided MA squared, which then can be rewritten as G squared divided MA squared, the sum N going from 0 to infinity, P squared divided MA squared at the power of N. So the scattering matrix, so to say, the amplitude, scattering amplitude would be proportional to something like that. And if you would like to go to your theory, your effective theory involving only B, then it would be, of course, more involved. It would be something of the type G squared divided MA squared B to the fourth. And then there are further terms with G squared divided MA squared B to the squared. And then there is minus the derivative, so the D'Alembert operator on B squared, and so on and so forth. D'Alembert gives the pi squared here. And the details are not important here. What I wanted to say is that you can integrate out some heavy fields, and you get a Lagrangian which depends only on the light fields. The first term will usually be without derivatives, and then you have terms with derivatives extra. And then you do not see in this effective Lagrangian here, there is no A left. And this is exactly what we have done here. So we have took the LSM, we took everything out, and we were just left with these kinds of stuff. But because of chiral symmetry, what you actually find is the very same things, but you find that the first term, the contact interaction term, vanishes, and you basically start only from the derivatives. And the point is that, so it was then possible to show that this is true, that chiral perturbation theory comes out from it. And I would, maybe I just, I have still here, I can show it. I need again this because I would like also to show some equation and also what chiral perturbation theory Lagrangian looks like. Tomorrow we'll tell a bit more about it. But now I don't want to.
You can also obtain this effective Lagrangian for the B field by making symmetry considerations, because at your high level or high energy theory, you have a Z2 symmetry for the B field.
Yeah.
And then for the low energy theory, this the symmetry has to be conserved.
Then I just have to have power of b squared. But there is a point. If now I start and I write a theory only which depends on b, and then you have this sum, but you don't know the constant in front.
Yeah, you obtain this constant from matching conditions.
But if I start from the heavier theory and I go down, I get also the constant in front. And
yeah,
this is exactly what we have done, so to say. So let me actually project something about our paper. Here I still need. And then tomorrow we restart exactly from these things, and then I will say more about condensation. And there are other things that I would like to do. I will not manage everything. There is also large and C. Maybe we say just a couple of words, but maybe we should say something about the baryon, at least about the proton, because we didn't touch the baryons up to now only by words, but I think it would be good to say also something about the proton as a diquark quark state, which actually is a good model for understanding the proton. Where is it now? When did we put it online? This is a theory of ambulance chasing 9. This is our. Where is it? Here. Oops. Why doesn't it control L? I cannot. So this is our paper. Let me just show how the chiral perturbation theory Lagrangian looks like. This is, in the end, chiral perturbation theory, which starts only from the pions, is an expansion in pions. You see there is derivative of the pion pi, then u pi squared, with some constant in front. This term here should be proportional to the explicit breaking of symmetry, because it's p to the fourth, it should vanish in the chiral limit. And tomorrow more about how to derive this. But this is what chiral perturbation theory tells you, and these constants are completely unknown. They have to be measured through experiment. Actually, one of them depends on the f pi, and the other depends on so-called low-energy constants. These low-energy constants cannot be get, because this theory depends on pi and only on that, and doesn't know how to get them, so they are free. And you should also understand that this goes to infinity. This is the extended Riemann sigma model that I presented here. These are all the terms also, the G3, G4, G5, G6 in full beauty. And then it was, of course, a lot of work, mostly done by Florian, to integrate all the fields out in order to get then a Lagrangian, which is exactly that of chiral perturbation theory. It should be like that, because both are based on the very same idea, the very same symmetry, which is chiral perturbation theory. So the LSM, which is, so to say, bigger, should boil down to CPT, to chiral perturbation theory. And after a lot of work, I just look at this final results. So this is it, yeah? This is, in the end, what it is, the final results, or not yet? No, not yet. Where is it?
There.
Here. So one gets there, the Lagrangian, which is exactly the same of chiral perturbation theory, but the constants are now related to the constant of our big model. While in chiral perturbation theory, these constants are constants that cannot be determined otherwise. So, and then of course there are all the results, so, but the point is actually rather clear. So tomorrow, we will see how this happens, actually, how this chiral perturbation theory Lagrangian pops out when you start basically only with the pions. How there's more like the basic idea, not the details, but the basic idea. Okay. Then the numbers we don't need to discuss. Then I think it is a good point to stop today, and then we meet tomorrow for the last day, chiral perturbation theory, a bit of large NC, and some baryons. Okay, thank you very much.